Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, are you a pub goer? Have you got a local that everyone congregates at for celebrations or perhaps to drown their sorrows? The pub has an interesting history in Australia, and we're going to look at it tonight. Most people could probably deduce that its origins, of course, go back to the English and Irish settlers, although you mightn't be aware of just how many of them initially were run by women. Indeed, a proud Irish woman by the name of Anne Jones was the publican of the Glen Rowan Inn, where Ned Kelly made his last stand in 1880. Pubs were such a central part of the community that they could also double often as the town's morgue, amongst other things, central meeting place, town square and all of that. While their lifespan dates back to the arrival of the first settlers, they really came into their own during the gold rush, which began in the 1850s. No surprises here. Plenty of money to spend means plenty of pubs. Their history is as rich as it is long, and joining us tonight to fill us in on that history is Associate Professor Claire Wright from La Trobe University. Claire was first intrigued by the division of men and women when they socialised in pubs, but in the course of her research discovered just how many Australian pubs were run by women. She's written several books, including Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, Australia's Female Publicans. And she joins us tonight. Claire, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, great to be here.
Okay, I'm sure you've got yourself a drink already. Have you all sorted? Terrific. In our Melbourne studios, Dr. Chris McConville from Victoria University, who co-authored the book The Australian Pub and can tell us about its evolution and how it's been affected over the years by illegal betting licensing laws and its relationship to sport too. Chris, good to have you on board and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
I know this sometimes can cause a bit of debate, and I'm sure it's not necessarily easily settled, but can either of you tell me where Australia's first pub is? What did it look like, and was it a proper building? Claire?
Well, it would have been in New South Wales, obviously, as part of the first penal colony. But I'm not actually sure where the very first one was. You want to take that one, Chris?
Chris?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends what you call a pub.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the first ones were just a few walls thrown together and selling rum in the front room, and licensing didn't come in until the 1830s, but I think some of the first licensed places were on the rocks in Sydney.
Mm. Yeah, when we talk about a pub, I mean, it's short for what? For public house, isn't it? Which means that it's a licensed premise on which you can serve alcohol. Is that how it started, or did drinking have a different history at the beginning, Chris?
Well, it is a public house, yeah. It's somebody's house that's opened up in the front room and people can come and go, and sort of takes on the characteristics of a lounge room, I guess, initially. But the way the pubs developed in Australia move, I guess, pretty quickly away from that sense of domesticity. So, I mean, the ones in Sydney initially are pretty rough and ready, and you mentioned the gold rushes. Well, people are rushing from place to place looking for gold. You're not going to put up a solid brick building that looks like a house to serve them rum and probably adulterated beer. You know, it's just going to be a couple of hessian walls and a bit of tin and some logs thrown together and probably a dirt floor. So they're pretty rough and ready structures until at least the 1860s, although I guess a couple of the bigger ones in around Sydney Harbour, dating from the 1840s and 1850s, starting to be built in, you know, 2 and 3 storey sandstone then. But the really elaborate pubs are probably something that develops later in the 19th century.
Mm. Do you need a licence to operate them from the beginning? Is that the notion of them as well? I mean, today, of course, pub licences are hugely valuable. They trade for the tens and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. Did you always need a licence to have one?
Well, not initially. I mean, in Victoria, it's really only as the gold rushes started to wind down that the first licensing acts were introduced. But there were controls on selling alcohol in the convict era in New South Wales. But it wasn't what we'd see as a publican's license. It was just really a restriction on who could sell and who could actually drink alcohol.
Mm. Yeah. Could everyone drink, Claire, from the beginning, men and women?
Sorry, I need to get my drink and swallow that thought. Yeah, everyone could drink in them. And it wasn't until much later that there were these divisions about where in a pub it was conventional for people to drink. And it certainly wasn't until much later that there was actually any restriction about what gender could go into what parts of the hotel, or indeed what race as well, because Indigenous people were also banned from certain parts of the hotel. And so this was... it was during that era that was largely that we consider to be the era of the ladies' lounge, which was after 6 o'clock opening. Sorry, 6 o'clock closing was introduced initially as a wartime measure with the First World War, as a kind of austerity measure, but also as throwing a bone to the temperance movement that had been advocating since at least the 1880s to shut down the liquor industry, or at least have it more tightly regulated and controlled. So it was during that 6 o'clock, what we now call the 6 o'clock swill, that 50
When exactly was this? When was this? Was just after the First World War, was it?
Yeah, so the licensing regulations that restricted hotel opening until 6 o'clock in Victoria and New South Wales, and I think it was 9 o'clock in Queensland. But we really associate this kind of era of hard drinking, masculine, perpendicular drinking that becomes very much the symbol of Australian drinking culture. So that starts during the First World War, 1916. That first bit of legislation is brought in Victoria, and it becomes permanent in 1919.
Initially temporary. Right. So prior to that, pubs were open later, were they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Pubs were in some places open until 2 a.m. If you were down near the wharves or the markets, they were open later, and certainly they opened earlier in the morning as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to be a publican was hard work. I mean, could be on the job for 16 hours a day. And it was really that aim was to decrease the drinking hours that were available to people, which also did restrict the trade of the publicans themselves. Mm. They weren't that rapt about it. But it was, so that ended up being a 50-year stint. It wasn't until the late 60s that those licensing laws were then what was considered to be liberalised then by the 60s, because the sort of drinking fashion and behaviour that was ushered in by that early closing is what we consider today, you know, those really iconic images of the crush at the bar between 5 o'clock closing. Remember, 5 o'clock knockoff from work. Remember, you know, most workplaces ended at 5 o'clock. Seems unheard of now because we all work such odd hours all the time. But, you know, work knocked off at five, and then there'd be that 1 hour that you could get down to the pub afterwards and basically drink as much and as hard as you possibly could. And this changed everything about pub culture. It changed the architecture of hotels, when suddenly the 19th century idea of the hotel, where there are all these different kinds of rooms, the different social transactions went on in. There was the public bar, there was the saloon bar, there was often a lounge bar, and different people would meet in these different places, and they performed different functions. And there was, of course, also the publican's residence, because up until the 1960s, the publican had to live on premises. That was part of the licensing regulations in Australia, and it was something that made Australian licensing quite unique, the fact that the publican had to live on premises, and that the pub also had to provide accommodation and meals in order to get the license. That came in after the 1870s, when, as Chris mentioned, through the Gold Rush era, you could really get a license for pretty much any old tent or shanty. And then it was decided that, you know, to bring in this more domesticated form of drinking that also included providing accommodation. So women were obviously very much part of that earlier 19th century culture of the pub, as publicans, as housekeepers, as part of the domesticated aspects of hotel keeping, and as drinkers as well, because they were very much part of the fabric of community life, particularly in the rural areas.
So women, that's right, in your when you looked, you found women ran pubs everywhere. Was there a move after the First World War for them to be, did that decline? Did women cease to be publicans in the way that they had been?
No, there's no suggestion that women cease to be publicans. At the turn of the 20th century, over 50% of pubs were run by women. It was very much a girls' club. This was a business that was women were good at, and they had opportunities to go into because the hotels were largely owned by breweries, the actual buildings. And we have to remember that it was a licensed premises, so the license attached to the property, not to the person. So it was not transferable. A person couldn't be a licensed person and then take their license to somewhere else, to some other building. It was the premises that was licensed, and a lot of pubs were owned. The physical building was owned by the breweries in what was something was called the Tied House system. There was actually a Royal Commission into the Tied House system to get to the bottom of whether this was increasing the likelihood of public drunkenness and all the associated social evils attached because the breweries owned the pubs. But it did make it easier for women to run pubs because the breweries would give women the opportunity to become the licensees, to go in and run the business, to rent the premises. And this meant that women who were widows or who were separated from their husbands, or who were single women who wanted to run businesses and who couldn't get loans from banks at this stage. There was no other way in which a woman could get finance to run her own business, but she could get this opportunity from the brewery in exchange for selling that brewery's product. That's what the Tied part of the Tied House system was. And so this really led to an enormous number of economic opportunities for women where they didn't have very many other options.
I'm interested in this notion of the architecture of it too, Chris, because I got a friend who lives in an old converted pub in Collingwood in Victoria, and I mean that place is typical of lots of small pubs that you find in the older parts of all Australian cities, for that matter. That they weren't huge drinking barns; they were, you know, they were small rooms, as you say, with a small public bar and other small rooms that sort of led off them. So the notion of them as sort of giant drinking barns, which we often think of today, is not how they began, Chris. Is that right?
Well, I think they were, especially you mentioned Collingwood, those inner areas of Melbourne, Sydney, and I guess to a lesser extent Brisbane. The land's more valuable, so you put a pub on a fairly small block of land, and the classic design is just, the serving area in the centre of the facade of the building and a door on the left and a door on the right, and the one on the right goes to the public bar, and the one on the left goes down a longer corridor to a snug bar or a lounge at the back, and kitchens and toilets out the back in probably lean-to cast iron, and then upstairs three or four bedrooms, and that would be the those little inner-city pubs. But they're the ones really that were under pressure when, as Claire was saying, there's a war on licences by temperance movements, and to sort of defend themselves against losing their licence in the 20th century, pubs had to become a bit more elaborate and get a bit bigger and look more grand when they fronted the street. So you get those sort of grand two- and three-storey piles with all the cast iron and the big verandas and elaborate decoration on them, lions and urns. And
so all of a sudden you get a whole lot more capital invested in them too. So that means...
To survive you'd have to have more money to put into the building.
Yeah.
And you'd also then have to have more people through the front and more travellers staying in it. And, that they did survive in the 1880s because there was more money to throw around when the 1890s Depression hit. That's when a lot of those pubs started to struggle.
Mm. Just back on the ladies' lounge for a second, Claire. Initially, women were allowed everywhere in pubs, were they? Mm-hmm. When did the idea that women weren't allowed in the front bar seem to catch hold?
There was no restriction to women being in the front bar. They were not allowed to be served alcohol in the front bar. Although many of the female publicans that I interviewed for my book said, "Oh, that's rot. A publican runs their pub the way they want to run it. If a woman came into the public bar and she wanted to be served, there was no way she wasn't going to be served. And that's the way that I run things. This is what some of the women would tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But But it became more convention that the public bar became a male place, particularly after the 6 o'clock swill, and particularly because of some of the architectural changes that came in at that time. So when publicans realised that early closing was here to stay and that it wasn't going away anytime soon, what they needed to do to be able to accommodate that crush of bodies that would come rushing in after 5 o'clock was to be able to actually just stick more of those bodies into
the front
the
bar.
One spot.
Into the front
and
bar.
And also yes. into the front bar, and also to make that front bar more accommodating to that style of drinking. So previously, if you look at photographs of public bars from the 1870s and even earlier, you can see that they really were quite domestic places. This is why the pubs were called a home away from home, and some pubs even had that as their name. They were called the Stranger's Retreat or the Comfort Inn or just the Home Away from Home Hotel, and they were providing a kind of domestic service, particularly for men. And remember, in the 19th century, there's a huge disparity in the sex ratio between men and women. So there were a lot of single men who didn't have their mothers, who didn't have their grandmothers, who didn't have a sister about. And they went to hotels, often run by a woman, to get some of those home comforts, as well as to get their liquid refreshment. And so those public bars had what the publicans would call womanly touches. They'd have vases of flowers, they'd have soft furnishings, they'd have paintings on the walls, they'd have a piano. Mm. And you can see that in these early photos. Now, what happens after the 6 o'clock closing comes in is all of that is swept away. And the walls come down, so those little discreet, intimate rooms become one big room, and they generally, the carpets go, the wallpapers go, and they get tiled out. And if you look at photos from the CUB archive, you can see this modernisation of hotels where they suddenly become tiled, gleaming, stainless steel underneath the bar itself. On the patron side, there would be sometimes a stainless steel wall, almost like a urinal. Mm-hmm. And there are those shocking stories of men literally urinating against the peeing it up against the bar wall so that they wouldn't lose their spot at the bar between 5 and 6 o'clock. And at the end, when it was time, gentlemen, and everyone would go, the bars would be hosed out. Now, this is the time that most women left the public bar, and mm-hmm. for good reason, because yuck, really.
Mm.
And they didn't want to be part of this kind of style.
So this is
drinking.
Where the ladies' lounge started, was it?
So then this is when the ladies' lounge comes into its own. So there would generally then be another room out the back, a room that may have once fulfilled some other kind of function. Sometimes it was a storeroom. Sometimes it might have been the snug. And sometimes it was just a hatch that was cut through the public bar wall to a little kind of lean-to mm. out the back. And then that's where women would gather, and that became the ladies' lounge.
Mm.
And it became convention then for women to gather there. And then as culture does, it adapted, and women became accustomed to drinking in the ladies' lounge, and they liked it better. I wrote an honours thesis about a million years ago that was called Real Women Do Shout, and it was women's narratives of their time spent in the ladies' lounge. and it was not what I expected. I expected that what they were going to tell me is these stories of being marginalised and discriminated against and like a kind of sexual apartheid in the pub. But actually what these women who had been drinking in these spaces between the 1920s and the 1970s told me is that they loved it. They loved mm. having literally a room of their own where they didn't have to worry about male behaviour, and they didn't have to compete with the men for space, and they didn't have to worry about language.
Okay.
And they looked after each other, and they had their own rituals and their own culture.
Sure. We're talking about the Australian pub. Chris, just back to you. Pubs in Australia they started off as copies of English pubs, I suppose. But if as anyone who knows English pubs now, they're quite different. They become are they egalitarian from the beginning? In other words, is everybody welcome from the beginning?
Well, when we've been talking about women and then different ethnic groups not being especially welcome at different stages, but Look, I think they're originally set up in a pretty basic fashion and anybody can come and go in them. But I think over time, as the pub gets more bigger and people put more money into it and they start thinking about who's coming in and who's coming out, it does get divided up into different spaces and different people congregate in different parts of the pub. So by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, maybe the early 20th century, there are certain pubs that cater specifically or mainly to, say, commercial travellers, and there are pubs that cater to waterside workers, and the atmosphere in those are quite different, and a commercial traveller probably wouldn't enjoy being in the waterfront pub, and the wharfies wouldn't enjoy the commercial traveller's pub. So,
no, that's true, and hence the names. This whole
they
thing,
do differentiate, yeah. You know, depending on where they are, and a country pub is going to have a different rhythm and a different group of people moving in and out of it to one in the centre of the city.
Mm. The 6 o'clock closing, which began in 1916, this applied everywhere, did it? It applied in country pubs as well?
Yeah, not in Queensland, I think, as Claire was saying before. Yeah. Queensland didn't reduce licensing hours till the 1920s, and I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock. But, yeah, it was everywhere else. But, I mean, when you say it applied, it's one of those rules that's probably, more honoured in breach than in observance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things 6 o'clock closing does, it introduces this 6 o'clock swill between 5 and 6, but it also creates another clientele for the pub. That's people who come in and knock on the window and come in through the kitchen and start drinking after 6 and sit quietly in the back room until they get turfed out at about midnight. So there's a whole underground echelon of drinking that went on, and everybody knew about it, and every now and then there'd be a crackdown, but it was really the other side of the 6 o'clock swill.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And the hush money paid to the police, and so there's a whole extra level of vice that comes in. Prohibition, we only have to look at America's actual prohibition era to know that it's never really worked very well, and that it creates more problems.
We never had it here, did we? I mean, were there ever any serious moves to
there were definitely serious moves.
Mm. Did it ever, I know there were people who thought this, but I mean, did it ever get any momentum in Australia?
Well, it definitely did. I mean, in Victoria, there was a local option, was an attempt at prohibition where you'd have votes by licensing district, and if you got a majority, you could close pubs in those areas. So the classic...
Famously Box Hill in Victoria.
Box Hill, Nunawat in Camberwell, where there was only about 6 pubs to begin with. But even in the inner city, there was a licensing local option poll in the 1880s, and North Melbourne, which is sort of nestled in between the railway yards and the docks, had something like 57 pubs, and the vote there was to reduce the number of licences, and 37 were closed down. And if you looked at the local option poll that was statewide in Victoria in 1920, there's really not that much difference statewide between the votes to keep licences going and the votes to get rid of licences. And there's a whole series of areas in the old goldfields and in country towns and in the far west of Victoria that voted to get rid of all their licences.
Mm.
And then this is also the era when the Licensing Reduction Board comes in. So the state government actually takes a hand in this, takes it out of the away from being a local option in terms of being a popularity contest and a vote of ratepayers, and actually instills a law of the Licensing Reduction Board where there's a statutory number. It's actually an algorithm that's creative that says if there's a certain number of ratepayers in an area, there's only allowed to be a certain number of pubs. And so some of the suburbs, like Collingwood, North Melbourne, Carlton, Fitzroy, turn out to be vastly in breach of their statutory number. And so, therefore, the pubs have to be reduced. And then this actually starts an era between about 1906 and 1922, where the pubs were competing with each other to prove to the Licensing Reduction Board that they should be the pub that gets to keep their licence. So that's when Melbourne comes from being literally a place where there's a pub on every corner to only having one out of those 4 pubs that gets to keep their licence. And they had to prove, and there's, a lot of name-calling, and this is when they start to have to say that that person's not reputable character, and it actually does pull communities apart. But it's when you're driving around the inner cities suburbs of Melbourne, this is how you know what used to be a pub. If you're looking at now these gentrified areas, look for the buildings on the corners that have a door that's actually on the corner, and then on the street coming up from it, you'll see there's another door, so that it looks like the building has two front doors. Well, that means it was a pub, because by law there had to be two entrances, one into the public bar and then one a direct entry into the residences. Where the public, and so
exactly.
That's how you'll be able to tell when you're going going past those.
Yeah,
like
my mate in Collingwood. Yes, exactly.
That's right. Those are the de-licensed hotels.
Let's take some calls. Maria, hello.
Oh, hello, Phil.
Hi.
My parents were post-war refugees, and when they arrived by ship, people yelled at them, go back, the pub's shut at six, this is a real hole in Melbourne. but my father always thought this public bar thing was really hilarious, so when I was old enough to go to a pub, he took me to Young and Jackson specially to be asked to leave the public bar. So he ordered some drinks and they just served us, which was a bit of a disappointment to him. So we had to go to another pub to be thrown out. But what really got to me was an old fellow came up and he referred to my father as my friend, which, you know, at the age of 19, I thought, ugh, yuck. You know, he thinks I'm going out with a guy my father's age. Ugh. That was my education. And I got to see Chloe before most women in Melbourne did.
Ah, yes, exactly. The famous Chloe in the Young and Jackson's Y&J's. Thanks, Maria. Bye-bye. John, g'day.
Hello.
Hi.
I remember when I started teaching in the end of the 50s, into the 60s, New South Wales had a referendum about abolishing 6 o'clock closing, but they were frightened that the women wouldn't vote for it. So we had what was called the meal break, and the pubs had to close from 6:30 till 7:30, and then they reopened at 7:30, and the idea was that you go back to the pub as a family, or you know what I mean, and it'd be all different. And that way the referendum got passed. And that was in New South Wales. And I can remember when I first started in a country town, there would be five or six pubs, and then they would take it in turns with the police, which one would close for the meal break, and the others would just shut the doors and everyone would just keep going very quietly. And then it was your turn. Yeah, next pub down the road's turn next week.
Yeah.
But that's how New South Wales got rid of the 6 o'clock closing.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you. Just back to you, Chris, because I mean, English pubs, or many English pubs, I don't know whether that still happens, used to be forced to close for the afternoon, didn't they? I think they used to close at 2 and reopen at 6, many of them.
Yeah, look, I think it was a couple of hours in the afternoon. I'm not sure. But
this was because of pressure to contain the hours that people could drink.
Yeah, but look, I think at the same time, I mean, from the point of view of the publican, you got everybody out, you could clean up, set up again, and you might want to do something different in the evening. So there's certain sort of practical side to closing in the middle of the afternoon and opening again, just like now pubs can open and shut, you know, pretty much whenever they want to. So, you know, people vary their hours according to what the flow of human beings around the streets are.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of publicans actually like 6 o'clock closing, because it meant that they could have family time. It meant that after they'd washed up, cleaned up, counted the books, they could then go and have a meal with their families who lived there with them at the pub as well. So there was family time, whereas once the hours were extended, that's when family time blew out altogether.
Yeah. Rusty, g'day.
G'day. I was a commercial traveller in Victoria.
Mm.
And the common names in Victorian towns were the Railway Hotel and the Commercial Hotel.
That's right.
Now, the Railway Hotel was where the railways had an interest in the hotel so that their railway staff could stay there, all that. And the commercial hotels were all part-owned by the Commercial Travellers Association. So we got a cheap night's accommodation there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Because there's just back to you, Chris, too. There was an interesting, this whole travelling thing's interesting too, isn't it? Because I think, was it on Sundays you couldn't get a drink at a pub unless you had a legitimate, unless you were a legitimate traveller, in which case you could get a drink?
Well, the term was bona fide traveller.
That's it, that's a bona fide traveller.
I'm not sure what the distance was you were supposed to travel, but there was a pretty good racket in the big cities of taxi drivers on a Sunday being at a loose end and picking up a bunch of people looking for a drink and driving them out to, you know, just beyond the city limits, and they'd be signed in as bona fide travellers and then they'd get the taxi back. But then, you know, the people used to sign the book, as it was said, and you'd get a card to say you were a resident, and some people sometimes were and some weren't. But the idea that you had to serve a traveller a meal in the pub was something that, you know, went with running the business because, I mean, in Australia, pubs had a much greater emphasis on serving the traveller than I guess they did in Britain.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Well, I guess, you know, just back to you again, Chris, the whole notion of the pub is, particularly in country towns, I imagine, but also in the inner city, where people often lived in small houses and so on, the pub is a place of community was an important thing. It was a clearinghouse. It was a place to meet people. It was a place to do business too, I think. I mean, plenty of things were bought and sold in pubs, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. You probably wouldn't want to inquire into the origins of a lot of the things sold in pubs. But
well, they still are. I mean, I remember in my own life once I had a bit of work done at home on, I think it was a plumber's job, and I said, well, you better send me an invoice. He said, well, I'll be, and he mentioned the name of the hotel. He said, I'll be there tomorrow afternoon. Come down and see me there. We did the deal there.
You've got a notice board in the pub and people now have business cards stuck there, and you'll see people sitting in the corner on their laptops doing work, which, yeah, I mean, and people would pick up employees at pubs. You know, you'd pick up a crew to do a job in a pub, and sometimes you'd get paid in a pub when you finish the work. But look, talking about them as a community centre, I mean, often the pub was the first big building in a town or a suburb. So it was the first place that was a solid brick building, and it'd be two stories, and as we've been talking about, have a number of rooms and a kitchen and toilets. So really it was a place where if you wanted to do something that involved some formal activity or a lot of people would go to, it happened in the pub. So anything from a coronial inquest into someone who drowned through even to Methodist church services were held in pubs in suburbs and country towns. And one of the bugbears of publicans actually was that they wanted the licensing laws changed so that the police wouldn't be allowed to bring dead bodies into pubs and leave them there waiting for an inquest.
Oh, dear. Shane, hello.
Oh, good evening. G'day, Phil. How are you going?
Yeah, good, mate.
Hey, you guys, you talk about women running hotels, and a very dear friend of mine, her mother tells the stories of her and the girls and her son running the Ilfracombe Hotel in Queensland, which is rather remote. It's in between Longreach and Blackall.
Okay.
It's a pretty... It's a pub, that's it. There's a used to be a general store up there then. But the story goes that that it'd start on a Thursday night and escalate through to Saturday night. Sometimes hangers on the Sunday, depending on how much money they got paid from the harvest or from what they were doing out on the blocks. But the story I wanted to relate to you was the son was quite a good artist, and it was about 12 or 13. And had some visitors come through the pub. Anyway, they liked his art so much, they bought a couple of paintings that he had, sponsored him through high school. The guy now works for Pixar in America.
Hey!
that's just one little story of it. And I love to relate that story because it's classic of a hotel.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Exactly right. I'm sure that pubs have done that, and plenty more. Do they evolve over time? I suppose, Claire, too, don't they? Do they? They're the focus of community life. I mean, with the six o'clock swill, of course, they become associated with binge drinking too, which wasn't a thing probably before it, was it?
Well, that particular style of binge drinking, I guess they wouldn't have called it that at the time. But it was, you know, whacking as much beer down as you could within that hour. But there'd always been forms of binge drinking associated with, say, shearers who, you know, they go and they drink down their paycheck after they've come back from the shear. Or with travellers when they've come back from a job. So that hard style of particularly exclusively masculine drinking is something that is associated with Australian drinking habits and a particularly a rural population and a largely male population in the 19th century. But it's more that it becomes part of everyday, regular, urban culture that you start to get this hard drinking that women don't want to or it's seen as being unacceptable for them to participate in. And yes, pubs do change to reflect the changing times, and that's where things start to change in the 1960s, where there starts to be a critique more broadly of that kind of Australian drinking culture. One of your callers said before, you know, quick, go back was what they were told. And this is what people discovered when they went to Europe. People started travelling in Europe and they would come back and they'd say, drinking is so much more civilised over there. You know, you'll have people couples quietly sitting around of an evening in public drinking and having a drink together. And now that's something that's just not seen in Australian in Australian cities, and that whole idea that cities just shut down at 6 o'clock, and the idea, you know, what's that famous Ava Gardner line about Melbourne is a great place to film a movie about the end of the world? I mean, she was in Melbourne to film that On the Beach movie smack bang in the middle of the 6 o'clock swill era, and so that's what changes. There becomes a greater expectation that there should be more cosmopolitan form of socialising and nightlife and urban culture, and that's also a more mixed sex type of sociability as well. And so there becomes more of a push to change the licensing laws to push out the hours, but also there becomes more of a push from the women's movement into the 1960s, where there's a broad criticism of Australian society that it is sex segregated. You know, women can't go and share the same spaces as men at the races, and women can't work in the public service after they're married, and all sorts of ways. You know, it's only 50 years ago, but that society was very different from today in terms of the way in which men and women did not mix and did not operate in the same spaces together, and that comes under pressure, and then the pub is seen as being a symbol of that, and then that's when women start to hold protests in public bars where they chain themselves to the public bar and demand to be served a drink.
Sure, all right. Stephen, hello.
G'day, Phil, hello.
G'day.
Look, yeah, I've often thought about writing a book about my experiences myself.
Yeah.
I've had two country clubs, but starting from about 75 onwards, they both pubs I had were country clubs.
Mm.
But pubs back in the 70s, 80s, they were, especially in country towns, they were the centre of the community. If the CWA wanted to have a meeting, or the cricket team or the football team, you'd sponsor on, and it'd all be good. Back at, someone's talking about...
You reckon they've still got that place in rural life, Stephen?
Well, I think they have. I think it's on a grander scale now, because there's been that many pubs lost. But the point I was going to make was that once the end of the country pub, well, go back one step, the guy that was saying about opening on Sundays, we owned a pub about 30 mile out of the next major centre. And everyone had to come out from that major centre on a Sunday to get a drink.
Yep.
But we couldn't serve them in the bar. They had to sign the book, and then we had to serve them in the beer garden. So we'd put on a band and something like that, and it ended up tremendous. it was a bonder. But, yeah, and Wait, your pub is the blokes, your workers, the shearers, your labourers. The shearers used to come in on Friday night with their shearing checks for anywhere from, you know, $1,000 to $2,000, and they'd want you to catch it. And we either had two arrangements. But
well, they really, you know that phrase, Stephen, drinking your check.
Well, yeah, well, that's exactly right, and I've seen men do it, which is very sad.
Would you cash the check? You'd cash the check for $1,000?
Well, depending on who was signing the check, yes, I would.
Yeah.
And I even got to the stage where I'd go to the bank on a Friday afternoon and draw out several $1,000 in cash so I could...
cash the check.
and they'd pay me back the money that they'd borrowed the week before, or the gardens, or... But you become included in socially too, because I had one woman come to me. Her husband was a shearer, and he was just putting all these paychecks through the tab and all that sort of thing. And I agreed with her, and I said, look, what I'll do, I'll cash his check. You tell me how much you need. I'll keep it. I'll give it to you the next day. And I'll argue with him about it. So I did that.
That's a good story.
And it worked. And then there was a couple of blokes that said, gee, would you do that for me? And, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great story. Chris, I mean, there was mentioning sport there too. I mean, there's been a long connection with a lot of pubs and sporting teams too, hasn't there?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think sport's probably one of the first ways that publicans made money and got themselves known, particularly through horse racing. I mean, the early pubs often would put on a festival the day of a horse race. They'd give free drinks to people who might have won, and people would come to the pub and shout the bar. There was a big pub in Sydney, actually, in Botany Bay, the Sir Joseph Banks, that was owned by someone who was a mad racing aficionado, and he put a track out the front, and the veranda of the pub was the grandstand of the racetrack, and that did so well. He then put in another track for professional foot running, but he bet most of his takings on horses and died a bankrupt.
yeah, exactly. Yes, all right. Peter, hello. Here you go, Pete. Yep.
Yeah, good evening. Hi. My father worked at the Ford Motor Company in Geelong for 35 years, and right next to it was the Norlane Hotel, which is called Oppie's now. And he used to go in there after work for the 6 o'clock swill. And it was only very recently that my brother imparted a story about how Dad was there, and about 5:30, a guy came in with a 6-foot-long barracuda and suddenly, you know, wanted to impart it on anybody, and Dad thought it was a good idea. And so he bought the barracuda, and he came outside the hotel, and my brother had met him there and said, well, what's this now? And, you know, we weren't a family that dealt with... you know, recently caught fish and how to gut them and how to fillet them and all the rest of it. And so it was all of a sudden a quandary. But we also remember going to his hometown in Corbetook in the Mallee, and my father was a button accordion player. And I remember going up there when I was 12, and he would play in a particular hotel, and the publican from the other hotel that had the license in the town, because there were two of them, would say, send a message down with a courier, Gavin, could you just come up to the other pub for an hour? We haven't sold a beer all day. please bring the accordion up here and everyone will come up and listen to you in this bar. And I actually was with him when he did that, and the publican at the poor old other pub was so delighted that all of a sudden he was selling beer. The thing that really got me when I was 12 was that even though you were 12, on Christmas Day when we had Christmas lunch at the pub that he was playing at all the time, suddenly a 12-year-old was licensed to drink a pink champagne, just one glass, because it was Christmas Day. and I thought that was just hilarious. All of a sudden, we were allowed to have one glass of alcohol.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, that amazing stories, nice stories of all those days.
Yeah, nice stories. Nice stories, Peter. Thank you. Jill, this whole point of a small town and two pubs, you lived, your parents used to live in a town where there were two pubs, not many people? Sorry, g'day, Jill. Yes.
Hi. It was a place called Isisford.
Right.
Which was very near Ilfracombe, that a previous caller.
Oh, yeah, in Queensland, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. My father was the CEO of the local council, but he only needed to be there for about, 3 months at a time, so he would come and go with my mum.
Mm-hmm.
But I went and stayed with him for about 2 weeks, and it was really hysterical because everyone in that town drove everywhere.
Mm.
So there was one pub on one corner and there was a pub on the other corner, just one block, and they would share their custom between the two pubs because they didn't want either of them to go broke. So there was Clancy of the Overflow, and I can't remember what the other one was called, but I've got so many hysterical stories about this place.
Mm.
But people would make sure that they never walked anywhere. They would drive everywhere from one to the other. But they were...
That's right.
But they shared their money between the two of them.
Yeah. To make sure that nobody closed. Yeah, no, fair enough, Jill, too. What's the future of them, do you think, Claire? I mean, some say, pokies killed the pubs. They certainly killed some. What do you think the future of them is?
Look, I'm really optimistic for the future of pubs because of that point I made previously about that pubs adapt and they adapt to the culture of the times. And as long as you don't pull the pub down altogether, and that's really the devastating thing when you see that, particularly in the inner city areas where the real estate prices and land value is just so high and people will buy the pub and knock the whole thing down and put a million dog box units up on it. And that's what kills the pub. Putting some pokies in, that's part of the, unfortunately, the culture of our times. But you can rip the pokies out and you can take the ugly Perspex signs that are advertising the pub, the pokies off the front of the pub. You can just unbolt them from the bluestone building or the veranda, the lacework veranda, whatever it's attached to. And the pubs will live on and their function will change accordingly. There's some people that say, and I'm an advocate for this, that all of those inner city pubs that have those rooms that were previously the accommodation that pubs had to offer and that became defunct once you didn't have to serve travellers to get a licence, and also once motels came in and other forms of hotels. And all of the inner city pubs have all of those bedrooms still upstairs that are unused. Now, maybe pubs will end up turning those into writer's spaces or artist spaces, and there'll be a kind of Berlin-style revival of the inner city that's based on an artistic kind of core and community that happens in those pubs. Some pubs are doing that already. I think that the architecture of pubs can change. I think that some of the function of pubs changes according to the times. But they have a really important role in both the aesthetics of our major cities and of the community life of our major cities. We're finding now when so many people are living alone, single-person households are now the norm, that people want that home away from home again. They want to go somewhere where they can watch a sporting event on a big screen with other people together. They want to be sociable, and maybe they have to buy a beer in order to do that. Or maybe they just get a kind of gastro pub meal. Mm. The pubs have... obviously competing on the open market with all the other forms of hospitality that are now available. So they've got great wine lists, they've got great food, and they've got music, and I think they're a thriving part of our cities.
You're so optimistic about it all, Chris?
Well, I think a lot more pubs are going to close down, but I think the good ones will survive. But I think we get a bit carried away with the impact of pokies. Most pubs in Australia don't have poker machines.
No, that's true.
And in Victoria, I think there's poker machines in less than 20% of pubs. Yeah. But look, it's a hard road because anybody just about nowadays can sell alcohol.
I was going to say, that's right, that's true. In a land where really you can get a drink and have it almost anywhere, yeah, you do worry. Look, we've run out of time, sadly, but it's been great to talk with you. Claire Wright from La Trobe, thank you. And Chris McConville from Victoria University, thank you too, Chris. Of you. And thanks to the texters and calls as well, as we looked at the history of pubs and drinking in Australia.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.